Okay, this is an unscripted talk, so I'm going to be talking around the subject of stream winning. So it might not really have a logical progression, but I hope it's interesting nonetheless. Stream winning, some of you will be familiar with the term, others perhaps not. It's an extremely significant term in Buddha's teaching. Streaming winning is an event, you'd have to say, in the course of insight training, and contained within the event is the first glimpse of what lies beyond the conditioned and conditioning universe, i.e. Nibbana, or Nirvana if you prefer the Sanskrit. So it's a brief glimpse of what lies beyond the conditioned and conditioning universe. And it's very significant in the fact you'd say it's pivotal in terms of someone's insight training. Because it's with that first glimpse that it becomes inevitable that someone will become enlightened. Before that, enlightenment was perhaps a possibility, but at the point of stream winning, it becomes an inevitability. And this is where we get the actual term stream winner from, because the Buddha likened it to a stream where the stream of consciousness, as it were, is diverted towards the realization of enlightenment. And it's said that somebody who becomes a stream winner changes their lineage from that of an ordinary worldling to a noble one, somebody who is destined to realise the complete cessation of suffering. So it's all rather splendid to realise that, or to have that first glimpse. In order to help place stream winning in the context of the overall training, if I may, I'll just step back a couple of paces and just give you an overview of the Buddha's teaching. As I think most of us are familiar with, the Buddha encapsulated his entire teaching in what are called the Four Noble Truths. First noble truth being that life is suffering. It's deeply unsatisfactory, given that we're born, given that there is birth to anything, there is aging and decay and death of that thing. The things of the world can't be relied upon. And this, of course, means that there is grief, sorrow, lamentation, pain and despair. Conditioned universe operates through impersonal conditions, which means that we are separated from the things that we love, we're united with things that we do not love, and often we can't get what we want. And even if we do get what we want, we then lose it again. He sums it up by saying that with regard to the five aggregates, the five clinging aggregates, that they indeed are suffering. So the very fundamental nature of existence is one of suffering. The cause, the second noble truth, is the passionate resistance. Wanting life to be different than it is creates this perpetual movement, psychological movement of trying to obtain fulfillment and wholeness and satisfaction from a world that simply cannot provide it. And so there's this endless becoming, this endless seeking for lasting happiness, and which just perpetuates the round of suffering. The Buddha maintained with his third noble truth, that there is indeed a complete cessation to suffering by realizing that which lies beyond the conditioned and conditioning universe. There is to be found true fulfillment, true happiness, and true peace. And with his fourth noble truth, he was stating categorically that there is a way that anyone can come to discover the truth of the cessation of suffering for themselves. So we have the four noble truths, and then he explains the Noble Eightfold Path being the way to realize the cessation of suffering. Now, nobody can make enlightenment happen. That which lies beyond conditions is not itself a condition. It has no cause, it does not arise, and it does not cease. So nothing that we can do can make enlightenment happen. And this needs to be well understood. The path isn't about trying to make enlightenment happen. A very simple analogy, I used it on the back of my book. The sun shines irrespective of whether there are clouds in the sky. It may very well be that we can't see the sunshine because of the clouds, but that's not the fault of the sun. We don't have to create the sun or cause the sun to shine. We wait for the clouds to pass. In the same way, enlightenment is just seeing clearly the true nature of reality. That's all it is. It's actually very, very simple. It's so simple, you don't actually have to do anything in order to become enlightened. This is the silly thing. It's actually the simplest and easiest part of the entire course of training. In Zen Buddhism, they call it the stepless step. Now you think about that. You're not even required to take a step. Becoming enlightened is that simple. Enlightenment itself is not the difficulty. Rather, the difficulty is what stops us from seeing it. What stops us from seeing the true nature of reality. And that's what concerns us with following the insight path. We're not trying to cause enlightenment to happen, because reality is reality. It's when we stop ignoring it, and there is nothing obstructing our view, that's when the true nature of reality becomes apparent. And that is difficult. Dealing with the obstructions that stop us from seeing reality is a whole different ballgame. And that's what concerns us, that's why we create the centre, that's why the Buddha created his teaching, to allow us to train in all the right kinds of mental qualities to help remove the things that obscure our vision. So, in undertaking the insight path, we turn our attention meditatively to looking at our conscious experience as it unfolds in order to understand its true characteristics. Are physical and mental phenomena transient or not? Do they last? Are they satisfactory? Can they be clung to? Does grasping after them actually cause our suffering? Are they controllable? Are they self? Can we own mental and physical events? Or do they just continually pass us by, arising and passing away due to impersonal conditions? Are they actually outside of our control? This is the insight path. This is why we learn to quieten the mind down, to deal with hindrances, to put them aside and turn our attention to looking at the truth of the conditioned and conditioning universe. And as an aside, as I think of it, bearing in mind here that the insight training is not looking, trying to find enlightenment. It's not trying to transcend conditioned and conditioning phenomena. The insight training is looking at conditioned and conditioning phenomena. And that needs to be well understood. So it's not about trying to get some other reality to occur. It is just about observing experience as it unfolds. So there is this course of training, this insight training, which is dedicated to observing our conscious experience as it unfolds in order to understand its true characteristics. Now, in the course of that training, there are four events that occur that punctuate that training. To give them their designation in the Buddha's teaching, they're called the supramundane path and fruition. That's their technical name. And essentially, they are four moments, and each one is just a very brief finger snap moment when the mind, because of its insight into the true nature of conditioned and conditioning phenomena, mind and body, observing it arising and passing away, for a brief moment loses interest, loses its addiction, its grasping after the conditioned universe, and the mind alights on what has always been there but has always been ignored, which is that which lies beyond the conditioned and conditioning universe. And there are four of these moments. They're the supramundane, path, and fruition. So each of these events is the outcome of meditative insight. And they're given names. The first of the four events is called stream winning. The second is called once returner. The third is called non-returner, and the fourth is called arahant. Now, they're all, of course, deeply significant, because they're all glimpses of the beyond. And they have a tremendously powerful effect on the mind and change the course of somebody's life. Stream winning is especially important because it represents this division where somebody goes from being somebody who could just keep being reborn endlessly to somebody who will make an end of suffering and rebirth in no more than 7 lifetimes. That's as it's stated in the Buddha's teaching. So this is somebody who goes from having at best the possibility or even the probability of enlightenment to the inevitability of enlightenment. So the vast majority of people who come to the Buddha's teaching are working to reach that point. Having reached that point, of course, it makes a lot of sense to keep practicing and keep working to go through these other fruitions so that you can bring that 7 lifetimes down, down and down until it becomes something that is not only inevitable, but it could happen at any moment. All sounds all very well and good, so you learn how to quieten the mind down, you learn where to place your attention in terms of looking at conditioned and conditioning phenomena arising and passing away. That might sound a bit challenging, but really we're only talking about sights and sounds and tastes and touches and smells. We're talking about thoughts and feelings, perceptions, all the stuff with which you are intimately familiar with all the time. This should be quite straightforward, I would have thought. You just learn how to quieten the mind down, place your attention in the right area, and just keep observing things and rising and passing away. Why does it take such a long time, and why is it such a blooming hassle? It's because of the things that obstruct us. It's because of the things that obstruct the clear seeing into reality. We know and understand things like the hindrances, that we sit down to meditate and we get caught up in a daydream, we get caught up in planning, we get caught up in worrying about something. All these conscious aspects of our experience prevent us at that time from looking clearly at reality. But the roots of the problem, the roots of those inefficient behaviours run very, very deeply indeed. And the Buddha talked about there being fetters that keep us tied to an ignorant, illusory notion of the world and stop us from seeing its true nature. And as we go through the insight training and we reach each of these fruitions, certain of these fetters come to be removed. They no longer tie us to an ignorant view of life. It's these fetters that the insight work is digging up and getting rid of. It's these fetters that stop us from just automatically becoming enlightened. But they are deeply rooted. They're deeply rooted emotional, can't quite find the right word. Emotional attitudes doesn't seem to quite cover it, but it'll have to do for now. Don't want to lose my flow. So, for instance, on the first path, the fetters that have to be dealt with are the fetters of personality belief, the fetters of attachment to rule and ritual, and the fetter of skeptical doubt. On the second and third path, and it takes two paths to deal with, the fetters are of greed and hatred. And just to round it off, on the fourth path, the fetters are attachment to fine material existence, attachment to immaterial existence, the fetter of restlessness, of ignorance, and the I am conceit. So there are 10 in total. The most important for the vast majority of people that enter into the Buddhist training are the first three. And what you find is that your path to the first fruition is not an easy one because of these three fetters. Fetter of personality belief, the fetter of attachment to rule and ritual, and the fetter of skeptical doubt. So it seems like a sensible thing to try to give you some examples of how these fetters get in the way. Let's see, it's picking an example. If I pick a right example, it'll help to explain what these fetters actually are. So, all right, let's try this one, see if it works. If not, I'll try another one. So, somebody comes to meditation having already dabbled, that's probably not a very charitable way of putting it, but having looked at various spiritual ways, disciplines in the past, and perhaps they had created a practice for themselves. So what happens when they come to train here? Well, we automatically say, as we do for everyone, are you willing to accept instruction? Are you willing to do things our way? Now, it might very well be that the person isn't prepared to, because it might very well be that although we observe the breathing process at the abdomen, they've got used to observing the breathing process, say, at the nose tip, and that's their way of doing it, and they don't want to change. Now, in what way is this a fetter? Because ultimately, it doesn't actually matter whether you watch the breath at the nose tip or the abdomen, because it's only choosing a suitable object in order to concentrate. Why is it that we would like people who attend to all do it in the right way? Well, you think about what it is that somebody is saying if they're saying, no, I want to do it my way, in regards to these fetters. So they have created a rule in one way or another that they live by, that they do the meditation in a certain way. That then is attached to and becomes a part of how they consider themselves to be, part of what they consider their personality to be. So they very much identify with that self-created rule that that's the way you do it, you don't do it in another way. So already you've got two of the three fetters. You've got the fetter of personality belief and the rule, attachment to the rule. Can you see how it works? So they don't want to give up the rule because that would be, as it were, to give something of their own personality up, or what they consider themselves to be, because they identify with it. Were they to do so, they would be, it would appear to them to be in a very uncertain place, because the rule was giving them a sense of certainty about their lives and what they were doing, in this case, spiritual discipline. So to remove the rule and to be willing to adapt to somebody else's idea of what the spiritual path is, and to be open to that based on the fact that they might not know what they're talking about, gives them a sense of deep insecurity. That's why we create our little rule books that we go through life with, because it gives us a sense of security. So now you have all three of the fetters, and they all condition one another. Right, and so this is before somebody's got through the door. This is before somebody's actually started meditating. And I've had it on many, many occasions that people have come to the first interview to say hello and meet and talk about the Buddhist teaching, and they just simply haven't agreed with the way in which we do things here, and have chosen not to come along, which is entirely acceptable. Because I certainly wouldn't want somebody coming along who wasn't open to adapting even that much. And the whole thing about the first path is that it is learning to adapt. It's learning to take you out of the equation. The whole thing about the first path is it's very much about one's view of oneself in contradistinction to the world around you. Essentially, you think you're the center of the universe type stuff. And it's that self-obsession, that continual attempt to actualize the self, to get one's own way, to have one's model of oneself reflected in the eyes of others. All that behaviour, that desire to display one's credentials as a way of actualising oneself, all of that self-orientated behaviour has to be dealt with and let go of. Let me give another example. When you get into the meditation itself and these fetters start to operate. So remember that we only really start to deal with the fetter of hatred on the second path. But it may very well be that hatred comes up strongly when you meditate. And the idea is, on the first path, and the idea is that you become aware of the hatred, you acknowledge the hatred, you do not seek a solution to the hatred, but gain wisdom into the true nature of the hatred by allowing it to be and allowing to see that it's conditioned and it's transient. It arises due to conditions and passes away. So you gain wisdom into suffering by allowing the suffering to be and observing the resistances arising. Now, it's a bit technical, but for the person on the first path, it's not actually the hatred that is the fetter that is dealt with. The fetters that you deal with are the three that I've already mentioned, with personality belief being prime among them. It's not the fetter of hatred that you deal with, but it's your view of yourself in regard to hatred that you have to deal with. It could be greed, it could be hatred, it could be anything else, it could be worry, be sloth, you know, but I'm just using this one as an example. It's not so much the hatred in and of itself, it's what that hatred arising now means to you and your model of yourself that you retain, your idea of yourself, your idea of your personality. I suggest for most people, they don't want to see themselves and wouldn't wish to be perceived by others as being a hateful person. And that's the problem. There is a strong desire not to acknowledge the truth of what you see in meditation. Remember, with ignoring, it's a volitional activity, it's something that you do. So to ignore hatred because it doesn't fit your model, your idea of yourself in your head of what you want to be, especially as a spiritual person, hey, well, spiritual people don't do hatreds. Well, no, genuinely mature spiritual People know they do hatred. They know it comes up. They acknowledge it. But for the person on the first path, that's where the battle is. Their model in their own mind of who they ought to be, what qualities there ought to be in this person, or what qualities should not be there, may very well be conditioned in early life. You know, parents tell you, you know, you shouldn't be angry, and that gets conditioned in, that becomes part of your rule book, that people shouldn't be angry. So when you discover within yourself anger as a quality, there is a deep conditioned rejection of it. And so what the meditator has to learn to do is to accept the reality, the truth of that experience, not at this stage to get rid of the hatred as a fetter, but to deal a blow to the fetter of personality belief, and to deal a blow to the fetter of attachment to rule and ritual, because that really is what the model in your mind is. It's the rule. You shouldn't be like that. Now that, of course, throws people into uncertainty again. You're being asked to go and sit and be with qualities of mind that you have always rejected. That's a very, very difficult thing to do. And so there's great uncertainty, and that can manifest as doubt. It's easier for somebody who is faced with this conundrum to manifest doubts about whether this is the right center, or whether this is the right teacher, or whether this is really a meditation technique that can help me. It's easier to entertain those kinds of doubts than it is to persist with acknowledging the hatred in this case. You see what I mean? So the mind can conjure up reasons not to continue. And that's why skeptical doubt is such a, of all the hindrances, doubt is the most pernicious. It's the one that can destroy somebody's spiritual journey. The rest can sort of hold you up, but it's the doubt that can destroy it, because you go, oh no, not this teaching. I'll go and try, I don't know, I'll find a Sufi place, see what's going on there, or I'll try a bit of this or a bit of that. So it does take a willingness, first of all, being able to acknowledge all this and recognize that the true spiritual path, to really see reality as it truly is, you have to be willing to remain in the zone, despite the fact that the mind is telling you, oh, run away, don't do this. There's a stage on each of the insight paths. Well, I'll explain in brief how the insight paths work to lead up to this. When we first start practicing insight meditation, when we've really got getting our views straight about mind and body, about how conditioned things are, and we're beginning to see that things are transient. Initially, when we look at phenomena, we tend to see the arising of phenomena. We see that something come into being, the next thing come into being, the next thing come into being. This is really life-affirming. It can be an extraordinarily faithful time. It's a bit like spring. You know, we've got the daffs coming up now, haven't we? And it's a bit of warmth around. And it's like life-affirming. It's like, yay, everything's coming back again. Everything's starting again. It's all arising. Everything is arising. It's all new. And so it's the same with meditation. So at that time, these fetters aren't really getting in the way. As the practice progresses, you begin to see the arising and passing away of experience. You see both the arising and the passing away of a sound, a thought, a feeling, a perception. And again, there is this wonderful faith that arises, a wonderful confidence in the practice, because the mind automatically, in seeing this, doesn't grasp after anything. And so you have these wonderfully content meditations. Concentration, bright lights, rapture. It's blissful, it's wonderful. You think you're enlightened, you think, wow, it's just so fantastic. Then, however, you start to see the serial dissolution of experience. You see things disappearing moment by moment by moment by moment. And thank goodness it's done in this order and not the other way around, because it's here that the fetters really come back with a vengeance. It's here that the fetter of doubt arises, because what you're seeing is really digging into your view structure. It's digging into your idea that life can be ultimately satisfying. It can be a very trying and difficult period of the meditation. It's here that you need the greatest amount of adaptability. You need to be able to let go of the way that you previously understood life to be. This is no easy matter. Nobody gives up really deep-rooted assumptions and beliefs about life easily, which is why you need the entire training, including the centre, the teacher, people who have experienced this period in meditation and can help you through it. But you can see that the fetters, the very notion of selfhood and the enduring quality of experience is brought under the most incredible pressure through seeing rightly that nothing lasts. So it's serious. It's grown up. You have to be mature. The actual process of continuing the practice will generate that maturity, it will bring that maturity. But that maturity comes from saying, despite the existence of these fetters, I am going to continue with the practice. And the teacher will always back you up fully and support you. In fact, I grin at people, because I am actually, when people come in, I shouldn't say this, this will be, you'll all run away immediately I say this. But when somebody comes and sits in a meditation interview and they're quaking in their shoes, well, in their socks, because of what they've seen in the meditation, and it's so digging into their view structure, I'm just so happy. It's just such a happy time for me, because I think this person is really getting it, they're really progressing. And I just encourage people to just stay and remain. But you can see how, in that situation, the fetter of doubt, especially, go, oh no, I don't. I've been coming here a while now. I think maybe I should try. You know, I don't know, whatever. And so you have to be willing to include the fetters in your observation. You have to be willing to include self-view. You have to be willing to include doubt. You have to be willing to include the desire to run back to formulaic ways of dealing with life. And you have to choose not to act upon them, but to keep practicing in the way that you have, because the way you've been practicing is right practice. It's not gone wrong. Sometimes the meditator comes and says, it's gone wrong. It hasn't gone wrong. It's absolutely as it should be, and it's going in entirely the right direction. That knowledge, that understanding of the dissolution of phenomena, and that how you can't rely on anything in the conditioned and conditioning universe, is the very springboard which will lead to the first fruition, to stream winning. It can't really happen without it, because you need that impetus, that desire to go beyond conditioned and conditioning universe. And that comes from seeing rightly, as it really is, the suffering inherent in conditions. So what will help on the first path in order to do that is a continuing recognition of the value of keeping precepts, of generating compassionate activities, because all of that is reducing self-view. It helps tremendously to undertake the practice as best you can, according to the instruction, and having the faith, the malleability of mind, the adaptability to recognize the value of practicing in the way instructed, so that you're not continually just reinforcing your self-view by going back to your tried and trusted ways of doing things. And of course, to have faith, but also a willingness and a courage and determination to practice regardless of what comes up. And having faith in the instructor, having faith in the fact that there are people who have been through this and know that it's fine, it's fabulous, it's the most astonishing journey to go on, unlike anything else you could do. And it works if you persevere. Okay. So what else can we say then? So having created this springboard and this strong determination to carry on observing things arising and passing away and noting experience and developing the insight into transience and the other two marks, there comes a point, as I said earlier, that the mind gives up its obsession with the world. Just for a finger snap, it is the most minute moment. And the mind alights on that which neither arises nor passes away. It's always here. It's never denied anyone. It's just that the mind completely ignores it. It can happen different. It can sort of... there is an event, and the realization is contained within the event, and you have to be able to clearly recognize what is the realization and what is a concentration experience, essentially. For instance, some people barely notice stream winning at all. It wasn't my experience, but other people, it arises with the most astonishing bliss and happiness as a consequence of having this realization. And that can last a little while, and then that kind of subsides. But there is contained within that realization, whether the person is really consciously aware of it, whether they can really discern it or not, there is this marked change that occurs. And I think one of the most evident things is there is this most wonderful confidence that is left, and that the person never returns to a doubtful attitude with regard to the Buddha's teaching. It's like that doubt now just cannot arise, because the conditioned and conditioning universe has been seen through, and there is indeed something beyond. I liken it in my book, the chapter on the glimpse of the beyond deals with all of this in detail. But I like the Buddha's analogy of the stream winner being like somebody who is still very thirsty, but now sees that there is indeed a well in the distance. They're still some way away from being able to drink from the well, as they would wish, but they now know that they're going to be fine, that they're not going to die of thirst. There is a well that they can drink from. And that is the quality of stream winning. It's most definitely not enlightenment, and some people fall into the trap of thinking that, because it is a wake up. I mean, it's a bit like, oh no, you can't say that, Paul, that's ridiculous. Well, I was going to say, it's like waking up and finding out there's been someone living in your house for 20 years and you never knew. That's ridiculous, it's not like that at all. But you suddenly realise that, I mean, people sometimes talk about it, it's like going down the rabbit hole. But really, this is about coming out of the rabbit hole for just like a nanosecond and then falling back in it again. But now you've kind of fallen back in the rabbit hole, but now you know there is a way out. That's what I'm trying to get to. So there is a fundamental difference now, and you can't fall into doubt about the Buddha's teaching. There are a whole set of wonderful qualities that do arise with it. But that does create a bit of a problem too. There is, especially if you can gather enough concentration together, there is the possibility of, as it were, re-experiencing the fruition, the stream-winning fruition. And that has a problem with it, because it means that you become a little bit bipolar. Because on the one hand, you have this wonderful vision of life free of suffering, as life as being fundamentally beautiful, mysterious, and wonderful. And then you flip because you start to become aware, deeply aware, of how much greed and hatred you actually have in your nature, which you hadn't seen before. It's always been there, but it's like you've brushed away three of the fetters, and so it's brought up the next two fetters, which is grace, greed, and hatred. And so you flip from this vision of the mystery and wonder of life back into feeling really awful, because you've got this intense greed and hatred, resistance to life, that is now really, really obvious. And when you reapply yourself to meditation, now the insight is really gross. It's not gross in a horrible way, but it's difficult to turn the mind to observing transience. And you realize, oh, I've got to go through all this all over again now. I've got to pick up the meditation and carry on. That's why it's really, really helpful to continue the training under proper guidance, because it for those that chance upon stream winning outside of a teaching like this, that can actually be a harrowing experience. So it isn't the end of stream winning, isn't the end of suffering, but it is the point at which it is inevitable that somebody will become enlightened.